lot of our interventions are early days, like the loan repayment program that you mentioned. We only started this year and just with 6 people, and we hope to go up to 50 people. But we're going to need a lot more efforts and a lot more changes in our healthcare system to actually make a difference that we can feel, especially where the needs are the greatest and the numbers are the shortest, such as the neighbor islands, especially Big Island.
Rural areas have had a tough time of it for decades, trying to attract appropriate amounts of docs and just general medical care. How is that going to be positioned differently now, especially when we know that the numbers have gotten worse and that they will likely continue to be? How are we going to find the right people to get into the right places?
That's a very good question. And I think what's going to have to happen is a lot of community involvement in the selection, in the welcoming of people, active involvement, engaging people in the community and getting them to stay. Because what we see is a lot of people, first of all, we need to grow our own, and we need to make good opportunities for them to stay here. In the meantime, we get people from the mainland who may not have ties to Hawaii. If they have ties, that's bonus. They're keepers. But some people, they come here, and then they find that there isn't the job for the spouse, or maybe the school system isn't what they're expecting, or the medical community is perhaps not what they were expecting. And another thing that I think, discounted previously and we're seeing a lot of is their parents on the mainland getting ill and needing care, and they need to return back there to care for them.
I mean, that's the story all over the place, but especially acutely felt when you have a whole ocean, or maybe an ocean and a continent, between you and the rest of your family. So it's just a lot more than the financial part of it. I mean, good as that may be and getting better, that's only part of the equation in how you keep a doc in Hawaii. We talked to a young man last year who was at JABSM and who told us, you know, I'd love to be able to stay in Hawaii because he's from here, but he said that he would be well over $250,000 in debt by the time he graduated. And the only way he figured that he could actually live his dream of coming back and working in a rural community was to go to the mainland for a while and not be here with his family for his family. That's a heck of a bind to put somebody in.
Yeah, and I would tell him, if he goes into primary care, which includes obstetrics and psychiatry, he could get that loan paid off in 6 years working in an underserved area in Hawaii. And well, that's the change we've made with the loan repayment program.
That's potentially very good news for someone who is caught in a position like that. But as you said, right now, there's only, 6 or 7 people that you've been able to help in that way, maybe 50 by the time we reach the next year or two. But we're $750 of doctors down this year, and that's going to better than double as we get close to 2020.
So, well, hopefully it won't double, because hopefully we'll do things to prevent that.
But you are such an optimist. And I don't mean to poke fun at you, but literally for the 13-plus years that this program has been on the air, we've talked about just this, that we have had a doctor shortage and a nurse's shortage. I mean, wherever it is in the medical community, we've had shortages. And knowing that our population is the longest lived of any other state, that we have our population aging, people who are looking to move here, who are beyond, you say, age 50, 60, clearly looking at this as a retirement place, and people who have been living here for quite a while who have said to us things like, you know, we'd love to be able to actually stay in Hawaii, but where we're living, in a beautiful place on the Big Island, for example, we don't have a hospital close by. We don't have enough specialized doctors. And so just to cut our losses, we're going to go back to the mainland somewhere, even though we don't really want to. So everybody is feeling the pinch of this, not just not having the right doctor right now, but people planning not to be here.
I can't argue with that, but I can say that I do think we have the resources we need to get ourselves out of this. That is, we have the bright young youth that can get into the pipeline in health careers, and we have the ability to work together in teams, which I think you're going to discuss more in this show, but can make it better for everybody, patients, providers. The team aspect of medicine can really come into play now.
You're talking about the patients that are at home idea.
Yes.
All right. Well, we're going to talk with some of those folks who will be on that team in one way or another. Stay with us. George, I want to talk to you for a little bit because your organization deals with hospitals and it deals with, well, we talked about the whole continuum of care. So you're seeing all of these gaps at so many levels and in different places. Do you have a different take about what it's going to take for us to be able to fill some of those gaps?
Well, I think that Kelly hit a lot of the topics dead center. From our perspective, of course, most of the provision of care occurs here on Oahu, so we have pretty good access and coverage here. The areas where we have a lot of work to do are with our neighbor islands. And one of the things that the hospital association that we took a look at is Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements. And that is Medicaid taking care of low-income individuals, Medicare taking care of those that are 65 and older. And obviously in our state, being the most rapidly aging state in the country, we're going to have more and more people on Medicare. When you look at our state compared with the rest of the country, our Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement is close to being dead last in the country. And so when you talk about recruiting and retaining physicians, when you talk about recruiting and retaining healthcare workforce, when you have the worst reimbursement in the country and yet you have the highest cost, one of the highest cost of living areas in the country, it's going to be hard to recruit and retain. When you look at many physicians and they look at the economics of it, they could go and be much more profitable providing health care on the mainland rather than here when you look at our patient population, especially on the neighbor islands. You're dealing with a lot of Medicaid patient population on those neighbor islands.
Now, overlay all of this with Obamacare, which we really don't know how this is going to play out. We have some idea, some approximation, but even so, every time it seems we have a conversation about it, there's more that comes out that we didn't quite figure in or we didn't quite know. And that alone has given a lot of docs who have told us confidentially, I don't know that I want to stick around and continue to practice, especially if we know that the average age of a doc in Hawaii is middle 50s.
Yeah.
What's the incentive for somebody to stay in the game, let alone, from what you just said, anybody to come into it?
Well, you know, I, kind of piggybacking on one of Kelly's comments, I think we have to we have to continue to try and retain the existing workforce, whether it's physicians, nurses, or other members of our healthcare workforce. But I think we do need to also focus on youth. And we need to focus on bringing people into the field. Frankly, healthcare is not only a rewarding field, but when you look at particularly the nursing portion of the industry, it provides a lot of flexibility, and it actually is a very attractive lifestyle. It is a hard job. It's one of the hardest jobs that there is out there. I have nothing but respect for our nurses in the profession. But when I talk to some of the nurses who are in the industry, the ability that it gives them to actually live the kind of lifestyle that they want to have, it is a very attractive profession to have. And I think we need to publicize that more, and we can do a better job recruiting people into the workforce.
Let's talk to one. That seemed to be just – you did a very nice segue there. Didn't even talk to you about that one. But Valisa Saunders, this is your life. I mean, you are – a nurse, and you helped to build out what we now know as the nurse practitioners program in Hawaii. Is life as good as George makes it out to be?
Well, I think there is a difference between the lifestyle of a registered nurse that's working in the workforce, you know, in acute care hospitals or long-term care facilities, and they do shift work. So that may be more difficult, but there may be some more flexibility, and they do have good benefits, and they have work that is meaningful to them. And I think that's very important to most nurses. Additionally, for nurse practitioners or any advanced practice registered nurses, and I was just asked this question at the Workforce Summit last weekend, what people weren't sure what the difference was between an APRN and a nurse practitioner. Advanced practice registered nurses, or APRNs, that's the designation from our state for the nurse practitioner, the clinical nurse specialist, the nurse midwife, and the nurse anesthetist, just to clarify that. So, but I am a nurse practitioner, and it is a good lifestyle. We do work hard, but it is, again, work that we think is important. And there is quite a bit of flexibility in some cases. I think we need to get more creative about that, really, for the retention, though. We don't have any nurse practitioners being trained in this state in the for the acute care nurse practitioner track. That's a new area. And some of them have come from the mainland, and I know that Queens has been hiring quite a few. And, you know, we need to be thinking about developing that kind of a program in the future. That will expand that flexibility and the team concept that we need at all levels of care.
Well, speaking of team concept, we just happen to have somebody from Queens, and that would be you, Nadine Tensale. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you.
You work on the other spectrum of life with little kids, and, well, as long as you get to be in pediatrics, I was 15, 16, something, before you want to have a doctor that's not taking care of little kids anymore. But when we know that families are shrinking in Hawaii, that we see far more attention going to those who are retired, people who are moving here, not necessarily being a place where it's easy to raise a family because of the cost of living. It's maybe a different game for you than for someone who is working in anything having to do with support, senior support. How do we balance that act when we have fewer families coming in and clearly a need for certain types of pediatricians that we haven't been able to attract?
I'm going to ask you to readdress that question because I actually do pediatrics and internal medicine, so I see right through a 99-year-old or if they should live a little bit longer. I'm going to have you repeat the question because when you say we're seeing less families, do you mean less are coming back to live in Hawaii? Or
well, fewer are coming back to live in Hawaii. We're seeing fewer families who are able to stay in Hawaii to begin with. And the fact that people are delaying the age of marriage and having children, that all of those things combined, the confluence of all those things, has shifted our attention. And I'm thinking about 10 years or so ago, there was a study that SMS Research did, ostensibly for nonprofits, to let them know that, hey, you know, where the attention is going is not with families and kid-oriented nonprofits, but really with nonprofits dealing with seniors. Okay. And the needs of seniors and people who are retired, not necessarily that are infirmed or the elderly, but really changing what needs Hawaii was going to have as we move closer to 2020.
I think one way that I'd interpret your question is to expand out. You know, our problem goes past the point of just a shortage in healthcare and a shortage specifically with physicians. And we could say that we do also, if we were really expand out of physicians, with a shortage of nurses as well as physician assistants. But then I think where your question is going is how has healthcare, our healthcare needs, how have they shifted? And I think one way that I would interpret your question is that we have a shift in our population. We have an increase in our aging population. And when a lot of our medicine was very focused on the middle of the age spectrum, we're now finding an increased amount, and that goes back to what Mr. Green was saying, an increased amount of our healthcare is being focused on the baby boomers and those who are aging in. So where we had a nice, neat pocket for our pediatric population, the obvious, which is set in, before us with our 40s to 50s to 60s, suddenly we have a robust, very active 70, 80, 90-year-old patients that when they come into the hospital, they need care. They may need care longer. And suddenly it's a little bit more than just acute care.
Which
do
means
we
that
have the appropriate nursing homes to go
right
along with that? And. And then it will go back to why we're here today. Do we need to place physicians at every point in care? Or are there places for second-level providers? Can, once they leave out of the acute care setting, once their primary practitioner is taking care of them in the office, are there places for a registered nurse, or let me rephrase that, for a nurse practitioner to be doing that transition of care or some of that long-term, they call it SNF care.
Mm-hmm. Which goes back to the idea that just because we have a doctor shortage with a certain number attached to it doesn't mean that a doctor is a doctor is a doctor. We have to get just as specialized in targeting who we want to attract and mm-hmm. not just whether or not somebody has an MD back part of their name.
And what Mr. Green was saying, and Kelly began to speak of, I think when Kelly's, and you have to understand and begin to take just a time out and thank both Dr. Withy as well as Dr. Sakamoto for taking what was a rumor, as you said, for the last decade, to putting it in ink, making it a study, and making it no questions asked, where are we short and how much are we short? And at first, there's a big focus on how many physicians can we get back up? How can we bring those numbers up? What will make the physicians happy? And all of those points are extremely relevant, from the loan repayment right down to equitable pay to decreasing their administrative burden. But what has changed, to answer, I think, your main question, is as we dial back, even if we were to flood the system with more physicians, we actually have to relook at our model altogether. The word teamwork and collaboration is really coming up. You know, we can't say, oh, we're just going to educate more nurse practitioners. We actually have to change on what traditionally physicians were doing. Should they really be doing those jobs, or can they have help in those fields? Should everything triage right up to them, that everything has to funnel through them, or can we utilize the fact that they have very smart, well-educated people who can take on some of that responsibility, whether it be making clinical decisions or administrative burden?
And as that reevaluation is going on and we are looking for a newer model of delivery, how is that syncing too with insurance? Because it's not just the Medicaid and Medicare patients, but it's everybody.
Where we are, and you use the term for a perfect storm, and a perfect storm can sometimes describe the bad. I would argue we're at a perfect storm, and we're at really a moment in time in which we can make some very positive things happen. I think when we look at the triage of the patient, the insurer, and all providers, we're really starting to get it. This is not going to get better. This is our very closed community. As Kelly mentioned, we actually have the resources. We have very bright people here on the island. And how can we come together? So when you ask the question about the insurers, I would say our interaction with them over the last 2 years, whether it be Kaiser or HMSA, they don't have all the answers, but they're ready to begin to dialogue and align some of what we're doing that it makes sense and it decreases the administrative burden. Granted, we're at only the beginning of this, but at least we've got them at the table having the discussion.
Yeah, and hopefully with a good attitude, because as you say, if we do nothing, if we simply do nothing or are able to bring a couple of doctors into the system by offering them some loan repayment and other nice things like that, it may not necessarily be the kind of targeted strategic help that we need in exactly those areas, or take care of looking at how we change this model. Life is not the same as it was even 10 years ago, let alone of what will be by the time we hit 2020. If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about the physicians shortage and where do we go from here? How do we remake the model? What people do we need? How do we keep more of our medical brains in Hawaii or be able to change how we deliver medical care? Does this concern you? Do you ever stop to really think about some of this as you look at, do you stay in Hawaii? Will you hopefully be able to have your kids come back to Hawaii? Will you have kids in Hawaii? a lot of levels of conversation regarding healthcare. That seems to be at the nexus of so many conversations, and it certainly is tonight exactly where we are. Our number is 941-3689, 941-3689. Or 877-941-3689 if you call us from the neighbor islands. We want to hear how all of this is affecting you right now. Are you really paying attention to this? Or is it going to be one of those situations when suddenly you find yourself needing a particular doctor and you find that doctor isn't really there for you at that moment, or you're going to have to wait much longer than you anticipated? Or maybe you're going to be with a nurse practitioner, and that's not quite something you've gotten your mind wrapped around a little bit. Well, tonight, that's what we're doing. George, because Nadine deals with independent docs, and they have to deal with insurers at lots of different levels, you deal with hospitals, they have much the same issue going on, unless they're strategically, you know, only Kaiser. But how are they beginning to create a change of model that incorporates this team approach which we've been hearing about now for several years, that this is going to be the wave of the future. No, the future is really here, and get ready for the fact that it's not always going to be that doctor that you thought was going to be at your bedside, or certainly, you know, long gone are the days of somebody coming to your home. You're going to have to be an advocate for yourself, and you're going to have to be a consumer in your own health care.
It's a great question. I think when I speak to executives at our member facilities, a couple of terms are repeated, one being care coordination. And that is putting a team of healthcare professionals around a patient such that they work in a coordinated manner to make sure that in an efficient way this patient moves through the healthcare system. And I think another thing that is recognized, even though we deal with hospitals, as you mentioned earlier, we represent the continuum of care, so acute care and post-acute care. And historically, healthcare has been provided in silos. Hospitals worried about hospital business, nursing facilities worried about nursing facility business, rehab, and so on. And when you look at the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, all of those silos are going to have to work more closely. And as it usually works with the government, they're not in many ways they're using a stick, not a carrot. And I'll give an example of that, and that's readmissions. And basically, the federal government is saying that if someone's admitted into your hospital and they come and then they're discharged and they come back within a 30-day period and they have a condition which should have been treated in that initial visit, you're going to lose reimbursement. So it incentivizes hospitals to reach out beyond their walls and work with primary care physicians, nursing facilities, rehab organizations, and say, what's in the best interest of this patient? We want to know who referred this patient into our facility. What is the history of their medical care? And then to communicate with either the family or the post-acute care center that patient's going to be discharged to give them as much information possible so that they can provide them with the best care possible so that patient does not come back into the hospital. And so that speaks to working in a much more coordinated manner across the continuum of care, and I think that is something that hospitals are beginning to recognize.
Does that also mean, though, that we're going to have more data about hospitals and we're going to be able to make better choices? We talked to Marty Makary, who wrote Unaccountable, What Hospitals Don't Tell You, when he was here last fall. And, of course, that's the basis of his whole book, that people really don't make good decisions when it comes to choosing, if they have a choice, you know, which hospital they're going to go to and why, and that hospitals are not very good about being more forthcoming with their data.
Yeah, I do think we are entering a new age of transparency when it comes to the provision of health care. Data is knowledge. Data is power. Obviously, with patient privacy laws, we have to be very respectful and honor those laws with regard to keeping patient privacy. But it is that data, when shared in an appropriate manner across the continuum of care as that patient moves through the healthcare spectrum, that will lead to better care for the patient. One of the things that is a major tenet of health reform is looking at how healthcare providers are incentivized to take care of patients. The historical care for patients was volume-based, volume-driven. So the more services, that's right, fee-for-service. Right. You know, the more you do, the better your opportunity for reimbursement. The Affordable Care Act is turning that on its head and saying, we're going to reimburse you for outcomes. You have to meet certain quality metrics, and you have to prove that you are practicing efficient care and that you are having outcomes that benefit your patient population. And that is really having everyone rethink the way that they provide care inside and outside of the hospital. And I think it's going to have a huge impact not only on the way hospitals do business, but on the outcomes for patients. And I think it'll be positive.
All right. We've got callers joining the conversation. If you'd like to do that, call us sooner rather than later, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Peter, calling us from somewhere on Oahu. Hello, Peter, and thank you for your patience.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for airing this topic because I think it's hugely important. I've heard from a number of my colleagues about this, and I certainly felt the pressure myself. And I just wanted to speak in a very experienced, near way about what it feels like to be a physician in Hawaii and to have to make this choice about whether or not to stay or to go. If I'm going to really boil it down, it comes down to coming out of medical school with a huge financial burden, being undercompensated, and having just a very, very high cost of living. I think I mentioned that twice to say how important that is. But also, as physicians, we feel rather overburdened. There's a huge population. There's a lot of need, and I think a real desire to serve that, and sometimes it gets overwhelming. Also, as the healthcare system, particularly billing, is getting more complex, this requires more and more administrative help, which, of course, comes out of the overhead. It becomes very difficult to make a living as a physician here, and certainly when we look at housing prices these days, you know, for the price that we could use, we could make a down payment on a home for here, could actually purchase one on the mainland. And to walk out of school as a physician and to face these kind of pressures is discouraging, to say the least.
So how, Peter, do you feel when someone says, okay, well, we can do something about, you know, grants and loan forgiveness and all the other things that might help you with your education responsibilities and burdens, but that doesn't take care of some of the other things that you've talked about. It sounds as if you're almost thinking about not being in Hawaii, are you?
I've thought about it in the past. I'm quite tied to this community, and I'm not going anywhere. It makes for a hard way to make a living, but it's really my ties to the community, my ties to friends and family, and just absolute love for this community that wants me to, that makes me want to stay and to invest in it and to try to help it out in some way. But it's very, very challenging. You know,
okay.
I've worked both for hospital systems and in private practice.
We get the point, but it's nice to hear that you're sufficiently wedded to your community to want to stay here and stick it out. And there are a lot of people around this table who are awfully glad that you are, and certainly those people who are your patients. Thanks so much for the call.
Sure. Thank you.
Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you call us from the neighbor islands or if you're listening to the live stream elsewhere. Dr. Tensale, when you hear Peter, who is a physician, talk about all the things, this is not news to you. I mean, none of this is at all something that you probably don't hear from many of the members of IPA, but that sense of being wedded to a community, it seems that's really at the heart of where we need to go if it's not going to be about the money. And we're not saying that, you know, physicians starve, mm-hmm. but that's not going to be the big driver, especially here. And it may be a little bit more difficult to have a life here. But feeling the importance of making the life here is where I think anyone who's chosen to stay in Hawaii says that's the whole basis. Is this what somehow, I mean, that's one of those intangible things you can't quite wrap your hands around. But when you talk to members of IPA, do they come across to that same sentiment? I'm wedded to being here?
Yes, and in one way, what the caller Peter was expressing is very discouraging, and in many ways that we have a term for it. It's called physician burnout. But I'd like to look at it from another standpoint. Despite all that, each still want to continue to practice medicine. Each feel a very much love and an obligation to the community. And when you get physicians to look you in the eye, they will tell you they still love to practice medicine. What the main question then is, well, then how can we make it a better environment to practice healthcare? And while it might seem, because of the study, that we are short of physicians, why don't we just grow and import some more? I think we've dialed all the way back and say, well, how can we make the environment better? I would argue that though it is an immediate thing, and I too have large student loans, correcting the income is not actually the first priority, even for the physicians themselves. Because I would say at the heart of it, when you talk about the physician makeup here in Hawaii, you were referring a little bit earlier, 65 to 75% of practicing physicians in Hawaii are independent physicians. That means they're doing it on their own. That means, just like he said, when the financial burden hits, they take it straight out of their pocket. So if you want those physicians to say, and if you want to make it better for them, we need to address what their major concerns are, not their necessarily their annual income. So how can we correct what bothers them most? It's the administrative burden. More and more are being placed upon physicians on literally a yearly basis. So whether a nurse practitioner or PA are allowed to practice independently, as soon as they take that role, they're going to get hit with the same thing and find themselves in the same position of burnout. So we have to dial back all the way. And this is where the insurers help us quite a bit. How can we make payment? A streamline of payment, both in the way physicians and hospitals are paid, in the way we do it. How can we take our insurers here in Hawaii and ask them, instead of having six different ways to pay the different insurers, that we streamline the way that goes on?
Somebody wants you. We'll take that opportunity to tell you that if you would like to join the conversation, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you're calling us from other than on Oahu. That's the number to use. That's okay. We will forgive you for that. If you could see this poor woman, she's just feeling mortified about
that. And I'd like to jump in on that. I think that she has a good point. That it's not, I mean, certainly if we have a shortage of physicians, that's still a concern. And in geriatrics, you know, we really have a need for physicians in that area. And that is a really growing segment of the population. And as you all know, that Medicare patients, they're not only a larger and larger number, but they use more of the healthcare resources than other age groups. But just adding more and more providers isn't the only solution. I think we need that, but we do need to retain them. We need to train providers together as a team. I think we're in this transition period where a lot of the physicians in their training never experience working with nurse practitioners or other healthcare team members. They don't know how to use the healthcare team members. And they feel like they have to do it all themselves. Mm-hmm. And that really creates burnout. And it's been shown it's not the most effective care. Team care that is not only just a bunch of different people, but a way that it's coordinated and supported is really going to give the best outcomes. And people, I think, are going to have the most job satisfaction when they don't have to just always worry about the bottom line and their liability. And those are big issues for physicians, I know. And we need to address those issues.
You're all talking about reimagining how we deliver healthcare, who is doing what, and throwing the door open and saying it doesn't matter the way the model was before, it's not working now. And to be able to look at who can do what in the best way in that moment seems to be going back to what we talked about a little earlier in the show.
I think the fact that we are one of the largest developed countries with the worst outcomes in healthcare compared to other developed countries doesn't speak well for the system we have right now. So we have a lot of great things. We have a lot of innovation, but we really have a lot of work to do in terms of redesigning the system.
All right. We've got callers on the line. We promise we'll get you through. Susanna calling us from Kailua. Aloha, Susanna. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. Thanks. I'm a physician assistant, moved here from the mainland. I'm from here. My husband's a physician, and I've had a couple jobs here. And as a primary care provider, as a physician assistant, I can say the amount of paperwork is unbelievable. In terms of medication that the patient needs to be on, because another medication, let's say a blood pressure medication, didn't work, but every 6 months, you have to send in what's called a prior authorization form. You have to fax a note to prove that the patient needs to be on this medication. It's overwhelming.
Susanna, can you give us an idea? Mm-hmm. Hang on a second. Can you give us an idea when you say it's overwhelming? How much of a day would you have to be spending doing that for how many patients?
I don't know. I mean, these are things that you do. I mean, these are not things I do like once a week. I mean, these are every single day.
That's what I'm saying. So how much of your day is not necessarily spending delivering care to someone, but having to do all the paperwork for it?
When I was in primary care, no, I'm not. But when I was in primary care, probably at least an hour. And that wasn't on top of everything else. Patient callbacks, just purely that paperwork was probably at least an hour. And if it was really bad, then you're talking about having to actually call the insurance company to argue about why a test is needed.
Okay, well, we hear
someone who's never seen the patient kind of argue with you and not even be clinical.
Susanna, we got to stop you because we hear a small person in the background there, and we're not hearing much of you over that. But thank you so much for the call. George,
okay,
jump in here for a second. You know, she's talking about an hour or so.
That sounds pretty good.
Which
yeah.
I was like, wow, an hour?
I could do that.
That
was my question, and I would have asked her more about that, but she was needed elsewhere. Is an hour realistic to assume that someone is going to be working on paperwork?
Now, I mean, I can't quantify what a general day would be, but I can tell you that most practitioners would tell you that if they only had to spend an hour, that's not that much. In reality, it's generally a lot more than that. One of the things that we try and do with the Healthcare Association is we go out to our members and we ask them, what are the regulatory burdens? What are those hurdles that you face on a day-in, day-out basis providing care at the front lines that you think could be more efficient and could help you actually focus in on patient care? And every year we have what we call an advocacy day, and we bring to the table those ideas from our members and then take them to legislators at the state and federal level. Over the past couple of years, with the implementation of quality mandates, what we have tried to do is pull together a matrix of who is asking us to report what where and what is duplicative and what is causing more work. And so what we do is we take these ideas to whether at the state level or at the federal level, and we say these are ways that you can make care more efficient and streamline care. Because there is a ton of paperwork. And with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, as it flows down to state implementation, there at times there's duplication of efforts, duplication of programs, and we do try to create efficiencies in the system by going to our decision makers.
All right. Well, we're going to be efficient in trying to move through those of you who are waiting to talk to us. And if you're thinking about calling, don't think about it much longer. Just get on the phone, 941-3689. We have a whole panel of folks around the table and Dr. Kelly Withey with us by phone looking at what do we do about this doctor shortage. It's not just as simple as simply importing more docs, making it more attractive for them to come here or stay here. It's a whole lot more than that. It's looking at really redesigning healthcare systems and creating teamwork in a way that we haven't really done before, which might mean having to have a lot more nurse practitioners like Melissa Saunders, who is also around our table. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Lisa calling us from Haleiwa. Aloha, Lisa. Thank you for joining us and thanks for your patience.
Yes, can you hear me?
We can.
Yes, I have been a nurse for about 25 years, and I went back to school in 2009 to become a nurse practitioner, a family nurse practitioner. I graduated from HPU in 2012, and it seems I cannot find a position on this island. The physicians don't seem to understand what nurse practitioners are, what we do, and on the mainland, you know, nurse practitioners have become, you know, a staple in healthcare, while here in Hawaii, it seems that, you know, why are they so behind in incorporating us?
Well, Lisa is nodding her head. Let me get her to answer you and to talk to you a little bit about that because she's been so instrumental in having whatever program we have with nurse practitioners in Hawaii.
Yeah, I certainly don't know all the reasons, but I think there are many. And I think especially in private practice, there are many physicians that have been interested in working with nurse practitioners, but they just can't figure it out. And we've had so many regulatory barriers to overcome over the last 23 years since we started this quest that they're still probably a little confused about what we can and cannot do. So even now that we have really full authority for what we've been trained to do, we're independent, autonomous practitioners. There are still many other regulatory barriers in the way of us actually implementing our role. So one of the things the physicians may have trouble understanding is, well, if they hire a nurse practitioner, you know, or can they bring them as a partner, you know, they don't know how to do that. The reimbursement for nurse practitioners on the Medicare program and other insurances is less than a physician reimbursement. It's 85%. Yet we usually do take a little longer. That's kind of the nature of our practice. We have a little bit different practice than physicians, although we overlap. So they might see that as a barrier because they're going to get the higher reimbursement.
But you know what? If the nurse practitioner is going to get 85% and a physician has three nurse practitioners, let's say, working in his office, seeing all the patients that simply need to have their chronic care managed, then he's going to make 85% times three, you know, that he wouldn't even get.
Yeah, but maybe they need some help with the business plan. Maybe we need some to get some business people involved. And certainly there are many opportunities.
They need to educate these physicians.
But, and I think that needs to start in the training. Right now we have a workforce that are out there, and how do we educate them? You know, it's hard to require that. But I think as some of the programs are starting the interdisciplinary model, that'll be helpful. But I think we're going to have more forums in the community. I think the redesign of systems will help as well. And what would incentivize them to and probably education and help, because it is something they haven't dealt with before. They're not clear on the liability lines, and that certainly is a big issue that they have to be concerned about. If they hire a nurse practitioner, that even though we are autonomous providers, they are told by their insurers that that does add to their liability. And it's true for anybody that you hire.
Really quickly, I just want to ask you, is this consistent that docs really don't get what nurse practitioners do and can do? And, you know, this woman got a lot of education. Now she's trying to get a job.
I think I do hear what she's trying to say, but I don't think it's that simple. I think you have to take your concern and her concern and put it in the Hawaii environment. For starters, like we said, most of the practitioners here in Hawaii, almost 75% of them, are independent. And unlike, for instance, I trained at USC. And in California, nurse practitioners and PAs are embedded
everywhere.
In many practices,
yeah.
But there are very few solo practitioners. Most are group practices. Mm. Therefore, the business model is entirely different. The patients are also accustomed to it. When you're in Hawaii, most of the practices, if you have two physicians in the practice, that's a lot. There are a handful that are a lot, but most are solo practitioners. They usually have one or two MAs in their office. They're accustomed to a very small setup. So now you're asking them to completely change the business model that's been working for them for years. Mr. Green talked about the stick. The stick is being changed from a fee-for-service, which means you are brought in because you're sick, and I will get paid because you're sick and I make you better. But it's not just that they're changing to a quality base. That's the business language that is being used. Philosophically, we're talking about a complete shift that now we're going to be tasked to keep the population well.
Right.
So now you're going to need a larger group of people, and it is not for
time.
A particular visit. So now we can expand out, and we can discuss team models. We can discuss maybe not necessarily one more provider in the office, and that provider could be another physician or it could be a PA. So I hear her frustration, but I also know where we are at present, and then we're trying to grow. Not necessarily we're behind. We had a different model to start out with it.
And very briefly, I think there's a theme that you can hear in this entire conversation. Mm-hmm. And we are dealing in a time.
Frustration?
Frustration, but we are dealing in a time of some of the greatest change in healthcare that we've seen since the implementation of Medicare and Medicaid. And one of the things that I hear from healthcare executives on a daily basis is, George, I feel like I'm drinking from a fire hose.
Yes.
There are new mandates, new regulations, new policies coming at me like bullets, and I don't know who I need to report to. I don't know what's coming next, and how are we going to take this on? And what it speaks to is that there needs to be a ton of coordinated education. And the last thing I'll say is I have to give kudos to Governor Abercrombie and his team, because they put together this healthcare transformation
and you're
project.
On that team,
and I'm on it as well.
And
this is a team that has representatives from the entire spectrum of healthcare, and they're facing that fire hose every day and saying, how are we going to digest this and make sure that we continue to provide access and quality care for the people here of Hawaii? So at least in this state, even though we're facing all of this change, all of this new information, all of these new regulations, at least we have a team of people, experts, professionals, sitting around the table figuring out what's best for Hawaii and how are we going to get it done.
And not that it should make us feel any better, but this is what everybody's facing. Mm-hmm. It's just how we're going to do it in our way as we're out here far away from anybody else on the planet may be a little bit different because we have rural areas that you can't drive to. You're going to have to fly to. It has some different components to it. But still, these kinds of questions are circulating throughout the country. And that's probably a good thing because the chance of getting some better information when you have a lot of people working on it, well, we may come up with some different. Well, we could be as hopeful as you all have been. We have more callers on the line going now to Sylvia calling us from Kailua. Aloha, Sylvia. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. I mean, I love nurse practitioners. I spend half my year here in Hawaii and half in New York City. And in New York City, my primary health care practitioner is a nurse practitioner who has admitting privileges at NYU Medical Center, which is a pretty fancy hospital, and prescription privileges. And I don't think Hawaii is the health state and should feel proud of that. But, and the law granting them the power to do whatever they've been trained to do is terrific.
You're talking about for nurse practitioners.
I don't think that Hawaii is living up to its commitment.
Well, isn't living up to it or doesn't understand some of it well enough so it can live up to its commitment. When you hear her say that, I mean, as many people have said in different parts of the country where you go, and it's a normal thing, like whether it's in L.A. or in New York, going and being part of a practice where nurse practitioners are just part of the landscape, so you don't think twice about it.
Yeah. We're not, and she's right. I think that, you know, even though we have full autonomy and full scope of practice in the state of Hawaii legally, you don't find nurse practitioners that are able to admit patients to hospitals. There are many things that we can't sign. I cannot sign the physician orders for life-sustaining treatment forms, which is extremely important in my work, and that creates barriers to people getting the care that they need in a timely way. They are not considered primary care providers in some systems at all. There still are those cultural barriers in the state of Hawaii that they have not been accepted into the physician-type groups. Some have embraced it, but there still are these other things that get in the way of us actually being able to function sometimes.
Which goes back to education and legislation.
It's some of it's legislation. Some of it actually could be done through the rulemaking process and through the departments. But it's, you know, we don't always have the resources in some of those departments to actually finish what they need. It took over 20 years to revise the licensing laws, the regulations, just the rules for long-term care licensing in the state of Hawaii. Over 20 years.
Which is to say that sometimes our time frame is not necessarily the one that is going to be necessary for people to get to the point where some of this is made possible, which is tough to have to readjust your thinking and readjust your hopes for a plan, particularly when we've got this kind of physician shortage. It's awfully tough. Let's take a few more callers. We promise we'll get you through if we can. Michelle calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Michelle. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thank you. Valisa, this is Michelle L'Esperance calling in.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi there. I haven't talked to you for ages. I'm not sure if you folks have said this over the air. I just came on about 10 minutes ago, listened. But Valisa is really one of the people, nurse practitioners in Hawaii, who have really paved the way.
Yes, we did talk about that, and forgive me, but if you have a question or a comment, I want you to make it soon because we are running a little short of time.
I'll make it
and
really
I
quick.
Hate to cut you off.
I'm finishing up my postmaster's nurse practitioner training, and last semester I did adult medicine and geriatrics, and it was so rewarding. One of the areas that I found to be very intriguing and problematic and controversial even is the whole concept of end-of-life care and the decision-making that families and patients and their providers must do in order for them to be able to have the kind of end-of-life care that they want.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there because, I mean, we've had whole hours where we talk about what's needed to be able to get to that
Excellent.
Point with end-of-life care. But for just this context, Valisa, I mean, can you speak to it very briefly about how you see this happening in a way that would benefit families and patients with nurse practitioners.
Well, I mean, just this week, I think we had a physician that I've worked with actually in my previous life and my current life really plead for help. We're working on a palliative care grant at Liahia Hospital with the University of Hawaii, and HMSA is helping fund that to really develop some palliative training and team. And he's saying, really, please, I would like a palliative SWAT team to help me with this. I can't do it by myself. It really is time-consuming. It needs to be done. There need to be more attention to that in the hospitals, too. And I know it's difficult, but to get all the right players and all the right documents and all the right conversations, but it is the right kind of care. It's the right thing to do for people. So palliative programs and grants and more training with all the professionals, but it's nobody can do it themselves. And we've really left it to the physicians, and that's a really terrible burden. It's just not possible for one person to do it all.
Which seems to be a resounding refrain of this conversation and certainly many that you've been having off air, too. Going now to Robert from KL. Robert, are you there?
Yeah, hi. My name's Robert Serber. I've been active with the Hawaii Island Healthcare Alliance on the Big Island, and I really appreciate all the things that have been said. Dr. Kelly and Sakamoto's work to identify the workforce needs and address them, the need for better use of mid-level practitioners. You haven't mentioned physician assistants, but they need to be part of the mix.
Yes, we did.
What's been missing from this conversation for me is a need for planning. Clearly, the neighbor islands have the worst situation. Hawaii Island has the worst of all, and there's no plan.
I'm going to stop you there. Robert, hang on a second, because George Green says there is a plan. We talked about it a little bit earlier in the hour.
There is not a plan for Hawaii Island. I will beg to differ with that. That addresses a structural needs for our island.
Yes.
If it exists, I'd be happy to be corrected, but I don't believe that's true.
And then, sir, I would tell you that the governor's healthcare transformation team is looking at the different needs for our neighbor islands and looking at putting together a plan to identify the needs for the communities that are being served.
Except that, you know, the assessment that I was pleased to see was by island, that the Hawaii Hospitals Association of Hospitals just did, assessed the needs based on priorities by disease category.
Mm-hmm.
Is your highest priority... cardiology is your highest priority. Diabetes.
Well, jump in here.
Mental health off the list, but it turned out to be the highest priority. My point is that there's never been a structural analysis of what our needs are. What hospitals do we need? Where do we need them? What outpatient services do we need? What are the structures we're going to do to move from an independent practice to group practices that are going to be able to have...
Okay, Robert, I hate to do this to you, but we're running really short of time, and I want to at least get Dr. Tensale and George to comment on that. He's saying from really a basic level of what structures, where do these hospitals go, who's in them, who do they care for?
So to respond back to your question, I hear what your frustrations are, but these are active committees that are meeting right now. Reckoning back to the Governor's Transformation Council, we sit on it. What is going on in neighbor islands is paramount. It is almost constantly brought up as the number one thing we need to address. As Mr. Green was mentioning, who is on that is every single major provider on the island, whether it be insurer, hospital and such, and the neighbor islands sit on it. What is being put together as we speak is how do we make it happen? How do we take the resources that belong in the state and funnel them out to the neighbor islands or build them on the neighbor islands? Is the neighbor islands or the Big Island feeling them right today? No, because this is live.
Yep.
This is happening as we speak.
Absolutely.
And it's going to take a little bit of time, and unfortunately, we're out of it. So I want to thank you all for coming. We could easily talk about this for another hour, and I promise you we will, because this is not going to turn around anytime soon. It'll be moving in that direction, and as it does, we'll be talking about it on Town Square. With very many thanks to George Green, the President and CEO of Healthcare Association of Hawaii, Dr. Nadine Tensale, Chief of Pediatrics at Queens Medical Center, also President of the Hawaii Independent Physician Association, Valisa Saunders, a gerontological nurse practitioner, and thanks very much to Dr. Kelly Withy, family medicine physician and researcher of the Physician and Healthcare Workforce Issues. Thank you all for joining us tonight, and thank you, too, for being here. Coming up next, a brand new show for Hawaii Public Radio with good reason comes up to you a little bit later tonight at 6:30, and we will be talking to you next week on Town Square and tomorrow morning for the conversation. Stay tuned. We'll see you in the morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Aloha.